it says the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And in the ESV and other translations, we have then these various headings that give us reference as to who it is that is speaking, and it's very helpful. It is something that we don't find until about the 4th or 5th century in the Hebrew texts, or even in their translation into Greek. But on the whole, it's a faithful description of who is speaking, and it helps us to see the exchange, the interplay between various speakers and various participants in this. I basically wanted to walk through the Song of Songs thinking first about things to know, which is maybe more on the side of sort of more the facts, the details, sort of the raw material that we're dealing with. And then secondly, we're going to look at things to consider. And that'll be a little bit more for us to help as we read the Song of Songs to take into consideration all that the Lord has set before us, and some of the application will come up then. So things to know and things to consider. Maybe it's much the same thing, but we will walk through it this way. So first thing, the title. It actually is referred to in a bunch of different ways, isn't it? Perhaps you've stumbled over it wondering, am I saying it right? The Song of Solomon songs, or this? Well, it opens just with the Song of Songs. People have asked, well, why? Well, it's much like the King of Kings. It's a superlative, or it's a word, or it's a phrase saying this is the greatest of songs, which is Solomon's. The greatest of songs, or in Latin, it's called the Canticles, Canticorum, which again is just Latin for song. And so this is an inspired love poem. That's remarkable. In the Jewish tradition, it was said that, and I think this is still practiced, that you had to be over 14 before you would be able to hear the reading of it and study it for your own personal study. And there's a reason for that. Remember, as a youth, reading the Song of Songs and being somewhat, not scandalized, but provoked and curious and wondering, whoa, all of this imagery. And I was struck by something that a scholar was saying. He said, Old Testament scholars especially, when they go, they read it, and it's as if they just zero in right immediately on all the sexual descriptions. He said, it says more about our state of heart that that's the first place that we go to, rather than stepping back saying, what do we have here? A celebration of love. A celebration of romantic, passionate, committed love within the context of marriage, but also outside of the context of marriage, and the build up to marriage, and then subsequently in married life itself. And so in terms of the authorship, this was either composed by Solomon at some stage in his life, and we'll see for that old age is actually, I think, a very strong possibility as to when Solomon would have written these words in addition to the book of Ecclesiastes. So the traditional accepted author is that it is Solomon, or that it was a song that was written for him and his court, that it was written for Solomon. We're going to see as we go into it later that there's a curiosity as to what role Solomon occupies in the Song of Songs, or the song for Solomon, or the song which is Solomon's. We'll see some of the uniqueness of this in relationship with Solomon here. But what we can also say, if it's an inspired love poem, and clearly you see all of the, it stands out the way it's laid out in our Bibles. Tells us this is poetry, much in the same way that the Psalms have a similar sort of paragraph form. We have all of the remarkable collection of details, all of the senses that are taken in. You have sight, chapter 7, verse 1, how beautiful are your feet. Chapter 4, dealing with smell, the pomegranates, the nard, the saffron, the cinnamon, the myrrh. Chapter 5, verse 1 is taste. You ate my honeycomb and drank my wine. Chapter 5, verse 2, hearing, a sound, my beloved is knocking. Or touch in chapter 7, verse 8. Demonstrating to us that romantic love, intimacy between a husband and a wife is sensual, involving all of our senses. And that's what also makes it desirable as something which we desire. For those that are young, they grow in appreciation or expectation of a full sensual sexual relationship. And that is the Lord's design. That when the Lord established husband and wife at creation, taking from the rib of Adam, from the side of Adam, a rib to make a helper for Adam, it was very good. And so we have to see that physical love within marriage is one of God's gifts for humanity to enjoy, and part of what God pronounced very good. I think that's a great way to summarize the Song of Songs. Physical love within marriage is one of God's gifts for humanity to enjoy, and part of what God pronounced very good. Undoubtedly, there are ways in which we pervert this, ways in which our love or our lust shows very poorly in comparison with the love displayed here. But this has a high view of marital love. And it also has a high view of premarital chastity. Twice the refrain, do not awaken love before its time, which is why this is a wisdom book. The Lord is setting before every person the stern warning, do not awaken love before its time, that there is a proper boundary in which sexual union is to occur. Intimate relations are for an intimate relationship and not to be squandered. And so to have a high view of chastity before marriage and marital intimacy within marriage. And what's also remarkable in this is that there's very little sense of sin or corruption in the Song of Songs. We'll see why that's significant in the way that Solomon or other authors explain what it is that's going on. But as one writer said, this is a canonical corrective to the perversion of sexuality. It is sensuous, but not lewd. It is sensuous, or it is beautiful, but it is not disgusting or carnal. And that's why I appreciate that he says it's a canonical corrective. There have been some that have looked at the Song of Songs and said, we have to make this about something that it's not, or we shouldn't really have this here, or we should restrict its audience. We say, no, this is a canonical corrective. This is the Word of God. And it is fit for reproof, for training, for correction, and for us to grow in love and appreciation of the Lord. And so take chapter 7. Just hear the imagery. How beautiful are your feet in sandals. Starting at her feet. Oh, noble daughter, your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Verse 6, how beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. That's beautiful. That's remarkable. It's passionate. It's sensual. It's delighting in the marital bond, and it's delighting in, as we read in Proverbs 5 last week, in the wife of your youth. Certainly, this is at the opening stage of their relationship between the beloved and his bride. In the opening stage, maybe when passion runs hottest. And yet that also sets before us, then if this is the Lord's canonical correction for us, his way of setting us an example and a path to follow, it's an exhortation for every married couple. And for those that desire to be married, it's a beautiful picture of what marriage can be, rather than what the world tells us that we are to do with our sexuality or with our passions. And so we are being instructed in how to delight. And it's also canonical instruction in preparing for marriage God's way. Again, 3 verse 5 and 8 verse 4, two key parts of the song, that refrain, oh, women, do not awaken love before its time. And it's interesting, those words come from the bride. It isn't even that it's some sage sitting in the wilderness saying, you know, I've thought about this and the best thing I can offer you is, you know, don't play with fire. It's saying, here we are with this bride preparing, and she says, I am so close to marriage, and my dear sisters, do not awaken this, because you will not be able to stop stop appropriately. Yeah, Deborah.
Why, how come King James just has women him my love for me, please? And then why does she call him her brother? I never understood that.
Yeah. So she calls him her brother. I'll take that one first. Is because in the ancient Near East, an unmarried man and an unmarried woman, what would be the closest form of relationship that they might have outside of marriage? It would be to be a brother and a sister. Unmarried men did not ordinarily sort of go out with young women. Their relationships would be arranged and various things like that. And so you think of the women and their relationship with their brothers as being the closest of relationships. And so she says, you are my, he talks about her, you are my bride, my sister. It's a form of endearment. It's a form not of in any way describing her as his sister, for that is forbidden in Scripture, but declaring that you are as a sister to me. Later in the song talks about all that you had nursed at my mother's breast, and that same sense of the intimacy that we are one together and having that delight in that. What was the first part of your question?
In the King James Bible, it doesn't say about just love. It says, awaken not my love before he pleases, like let him sleep in or something.
Oh, yeah.
They're together before.
No, I think that the love is the object of it. So it's not the man, but it is love more broadly. Because it is a wisdom reflection on that, you know, the passion of people together, of the delight that they find in one another, all of those things. And so it is, do not waken that love. Even if she says my love, it's love for this man, what that she is intended for. Yeah. Does that help? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I hadn't either.
Hmm.
Because it's as if the man was asleep and that she was being kind of kind to him and just letting him rest until the appropriate time.
Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong portion. That's how I understood it. Yeah. Well, I'll follow up. Yeah. Carter?
The King James has the word my, whereas modern translations don't. So in a modern translation, it will sound like love is the thing that's being awakened.
Yeah.
Whereas if the my is added, then it definitely sounds like the man.
The man is the object rather than, yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, that's helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder what, maybe just check in the Hebrew.
Yeah, I'll have to follow that up. Yeah. So one writer says, in the song, the girls, who are instructed twice, do not awaken love before its time, are admonished to wait for sexual intimacy. Their bodies are saying yes. Their instincts for intimacy are saying yes. Their suitors might even be saying yes, or at least please. But they are admonished to say no. The wisdom message to these young women is to wait. Virgins, stay virgins, not forever, but for now. Wait for marriage. That is wisdom. That is the simple wisdom in this complex book. And the writer goes on to say, and notice how Solomon artistically does this. The admonition to wait does not come through the voice of a celibate prophet or a learned rabbi or a stern sage or even a father or a mother, as would have been common in wisdom literature. But it comes through the voice of a newlywed bride or newlywed-to-be bride, who's a former daughter of Jerusalem, who's one of their peers. This is a book about peer pressure at its biblical best. I really like that. It's a book about peer pressure at its biblical best. She's holding before them what love is, what her passion for her beloved is, and therefore she's saying, you want this, not that. It's positive. The song delights in marriage and not merely in sex. And so in Titus chapter 2, verses 3 to 4, there Paul is instructing older women, train the young women to love their husbands. And here in the song, the young woman, the bride, is the one who is training the older women to love their husbands. If you are an older woman, you are receiving instruction from this young woman, this character of this young woman. That is, the song is like a splash of fresh water that some of us old lovers, this writer says, need thrown on our faces. A book that is like a splash of fresh water or delightful water, a delightful consideration of love rather than a stern lecture about it. And I think we do need to make sure that we are balancing this, that it is not always just don't. There's lots of different images that are used of why we, you know, young people are to maintain their virginity, are to remain pure before marriage, all of the exhortations that way. But is it ever spoken of in a positive manner? And certainly sometimes it is. But perhaps we can have a higher view of the delight of marriage than sometimes we pass ourselves off as. This is not helped by the fact, for example, Matthew Henry. He says, when we apply ourselves to the study of this book, that is the song, we must not only with Moses and Joshua put off our shoe from off our foot, for we are on holy ground, but we must forget that we have bodies. He's saying, as you read it as if you don't have a body. I don't think that's what the intention of the Song of Songs is for us. It isn't that we are to sort of remove our very bodily reactions, our consideration. Yes, I quest after, I long for, you know, the smell of myrrh and the beautiful things that are being described, the aromas of delight, the pictures that are conceived in our minds of beauty and the love between a husband and a wife. He says we are to put off, forget that we have bodies, but that seems to be a mistake. We are to praise God that we are embodied. Praise God that He has given us fitting responses to His good gifts. And yet, we are also to hear His word, which says chastity before marriage, intimacy within marriage. That we are to respect and honor His direction for us as we praise and love Him and grow in relationship together. And so, another writer says, the song is a song that Adam could have sung in the garden when Eve arose miraculously from his side. And it remains a song that we can and should sing in the bedroom and in the church and even as we talk among others. Whereas Origen or even Charles Spurgeon just mentioned, they would go and allegorize or make every jot and tittle of the song, as this writer says, each thigh and breast and kiss and consummation. One commentator says the phrase, while the king was on his couch in verse 12 of chapter 1, is referring to the gestation period of Christ in the womb of Mary, that the sachet of myrrh that lies between the bride's breasts in verse 13 merely symbolizes Christ in the soul of the believer who lies between the great commands to love God and love one's neighbor. Those allegories are orthodox. It's fine to talk about the two commands of God and certainly Christ-centered to think of Jesus. But they are exegetically absurd, that these are the sachet of myrrh between a bride's breasts are somehow not about breasts and a wife. And so he says they are. It's potentially theologically dangerous for us to go down this route, to take every reference to a thigh or a breast, to an eye or to a delight and make it about something else. We'll touch on that in a moment as we think of the way in which we understand the song. But some things in life are not meant to be shared. That's another theme of the Song of Songs. Some things in life are not meant to be shared. Some things are to be jealously guarded. The wife of your youth, or the wife that you are prepared for. Chapter 7, verse 10, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. That's what marital love is. And doesn't that fit with what God said? It's not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. So how does the Song of Songs unfold? It opens with a courtship, chapter 1 to chapter 3, verse 5. To chapter 3, verse 5 is the time of courtship. Then secondly, you have a depiction of the wedding, chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 5, verse 1. And then what throws a lot of people off is that chapter 5, verse 2 is, it seems exegetically, is a reprisal of past hardship. They have already been joined to one another, and in chapter 5, verse 2, there's a new period of distress that is described. You could say the story of our relationship involves this episode, and it's brought up just after the moment in which they have at last been brought together. And it's talking about her treatment at the hands of the city watchman, whether that was a literal assault or a description of the distress of the bride for her lover. She opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. Some have said that this is a description of distress in the marriage. That is possible. Or it may be that it is descriptive of distress before the marriage. And then it is overcome as they are restored to each other, which we see in chapter 6, verse 4 to the end of the book, the interaction of the bride and groom, their renewal of love and devotion to each other. Any questions at that point? Sort of a bit of a whirlwind?
Is there any mention of Solomon's first wife in the Bible?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, just that she was from Egypt.
She's from Egypt, but not that she's named or given any description that way. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
She's not named, but she's from Egypt, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
So this song would be about her? His first wife?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think that something very, yeah. I'll explain how this may be about Solomon and one of his wives, but certainly not the first. Because she talks about the number of other wives and concubines that Solomon has in the latter part of the song.
I thought that maybe she was Ethiopian because she's black.
What's that?
And Song of Solomon, this wife is black.
I haven't read.
Very dark and
ugly. Yeah.
Yeah. I always took that to mean that she's of the sun a lot. Not that you're saying that, but I know that there are some people that interpret that in a racist manner. If you say that, like, she's Ethiopian, she says, I am dark but comely, like, they would twist that to say, like, despite the fact that I'm Ethiopian, I'm still beautiful. I know you're probably not saying that, but, like, I don't know. You could think of it that way, but I've always read that it's just because she was, like, she worked in the sun. It could be either.
I mean, she's called the Shulamite. And that isn't a phrase that is referred to. It's within the context of Israel. It does seem she becomes one of the daughters of Jerusalem. And so descriptions of her, I don't think that, we want to be careful not to sort of say, have an exact portrait, because our portrait from the word will probably be different of some of the ways in which we envision this. The descriptions of this young woman and this young man will be different. You know, look at 2 verse 9, my beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Well, there we're not picturing that he has horns, but that some aspect of his identity and being and physical nature corresponds with that. And so I think we start to work up a description of each of these figures. But things to consider. So who is the beloved? That's a very important question. Who is this young bride? And what is the nature of the crowd that is around them? And where does Solomon factor in all of this? The traditional approach is to say that this is a description or a metaphor, an extended metaphor of Christ and his church. And we're going to return to that. I don't want to say that we must abandon that as a whole, but there is more here. It is not something that we read as if we don't have bodies. It is not something that we think is about love, but then we do sort of a double switch and we say, oh, but it's actually about something else. I mean, not to downplay that Christ and his church is founded upon love, but we will come back to it, and I think we're stronger for it in our understanding of Christ and his church when we see that it is also a celebration of the marital relationship that Paul says relates to the relationship between Christ and his bride in the form of a mystery. And so the second option is that it is Solomon is the male speaker, and the Shulamite woman is the female speaker, and then the chorus is the others that every so often speak into their situation. And it's worked out that this is then Solomon coming disguised as a shepherd. And some of the backstory is given, I don't think too fancifully, you can see how this works out, is he comes as a shepherd to woo this young woman and to make her the choice bride of his palace. And that's a staple of a lot of different romantic stories. Think of The Princess Bride, I guess. No, not The Princess Bride. There's a few where there's a man that comes undercover and basically woos a wife and then reveals that he happens to be much more powerful or much more significant than he is. Maybe the Christmastime movies that are shown about princes that hide away in university campuses or whatever it might be. Is this Solomon? Or the third option, I'll try to unpack this more, is Solomon the polygamist king who has taken this beautiful girl away from her home and her family and her betrothed? A Shulamite girl who resists and the simple shepherd boy who is her beloved. That there is a simple shepherd boy who is her beloved, and he is the foil or the contrast with Solomon, with all of his wives, all of his horses, all the riches in the world, and yet being met by the simple devotion of a bride to her betrothed. And he cannot intercede. He, with all his power, is unable to break that bond. And we see that in chapter 8, verse 11 and 12. For there we're told, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and the keepers of the fruit, 200. You may have that, Solomon. But in this, the young bride is resisting this polygamist king who has even taken her away for a time, and yet she is able to escape the city, able to return to her beloved and take delight in him and be able to enter into marriage with him. Look at chapter 1, verse 4. We'll sort of work through the book in this way. She says, draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. Where is she running to? She's running, it seems by the context, out of the king's chambers. And then she says, is she excited that she is in the king's chamber? Which would fit the second option, that this is Solomon and the Shulamite. She's thrilled to be in his chamber. But a lot of time passes before she at last is consummating this marriage. And so is it that she is opening up this song, draw me after you, let us run, let us be in the chamber, O Solomon. But then it's a strange way to say the king has brought me into his chambers, rather than my beloved has brought me into his chambers, which is what we see at the start of chapter 5. And so she says, we will exalt and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you, as the others delight. Are they delighting simply that Solomon has at last found a great wife? After so many bad ones, or after so many wretched ones, or those who led him astray? Perhaps. I think instead this is a description of this bride in her purity and her promisedness to this simple shepherd. She asks in chapter 1, verse 7, tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like the one who veils herself besides the flocks of your companions? And he answers, if you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow in the tracks of the flock and pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tent. And we ask, is this the king's voice speaking in code or speaking in metaphor or speaking in the midst of his elaborate wooing of this girl by disguising himself as a shepherd? Or is this the voice of a simple shepherd saying, come find me, O most beautiful among women, pasture your flocks beside the shepherd's tent where I dwell. After all, King Solomon has a palace to call home. And if you want to impress a girl, you say, hey, come to my palace. But that's not what's going on here. Then chapter 6, verse 8, we're told what Solomon's status is. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. And then the shepherd declares, my dove, my perfect one, is the only one. the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Now, the second option of Solomon and the Shulamite is that she becomes the favored one, but it's hard to see that as this remarkable display of marital love in the midst of the fact that she's the favored of 60 plus 80 plus virgins without number. If polygamy is a distortion of God's intent for marriage, then it's a curious thing that Solomon is writing a poem praising marriage and at the same time admitting to having at least 140, but we know it to be many more, in his harem. But what if this is Solomon questing after this woman, even taking her, and yet not being able to have her, that she is promised to another and will not turn aside? She's encountered the queens and concubines. They praise her, and she is praised for her virtue. She is praised for even resisting a king on account of her promise and vow. And so chapter 3, she says, "I, the Shulamite, seeks her shepherd love. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves." If it was Solomon, she could go to the palace. She says, "I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me." Again, I think this fits with a shepherd coming even to the city of Jerusalem, even coming under the nose of the king. It's an epic love poem in that context. And that's something that we see in various other forms of poetry, of Robin Hood, for example, going and seeking out Maid Marian so that way he can pluck her away from the grasping hands. What I think of the Sheriff of Nottingham, if my folklore is correct. And many other stories like that. A Helen of Troy, being claimed by someone else, and starting the Trojan War on account of it. And so she says, "My beloved," in chapter 2, verse 9, "my beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice." Kings don't poke around. Kings don't have to wait in bushes. Kings don't have to peer through the lattice. Because it isn't a voyeurism. It isn't that he's trying to check her out. My beloved speaks. Rule number one, if you're creeping on someone, is that you don't speak. But he speaks and says to me, "Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away, for behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone." Or in the words of Shakespeare, "Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?" That calling forth. And then chapter 3, verse 6 through 11, is this description of the litter of Solomon. Columns of smoke, myrrh, frankincense, powders of a merchant, 60 mighty men, they all have swords. King Solomon made himself a carriage. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. All of this is to impress. And then verse 11, "Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart." This is an already married man who has come in a mighty litter. A mighty caravan designed to impress, to sweep this girl away, to take her. But he's already married. The gladness of his heart was present when his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. And the question is this what the bride desires? Is she saying, "This is the man that I want"? But it seems distant. There's he is King Solomon. It is not my beloved in this instance. Go look upon him. Look upon the king with his wedding day crown. And then another piece of this is in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Also in chapter 6. "Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like..." I love this. If anyone tells you this, men or women, but particularly women, They're trying to be romantic, but not doing well. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. If this was Carter, he would be saying, your love is like a perfect seventh, or some other musical term. But if you're the king, it seems a rather strange choice of praiseworthy attributes. Chapter 6, again, your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes. Oh no, that's a repeat. What is chapter 6, verse 5? Is it the repeated? Sorry. Okay, that's... Yeah. There it is, describing again this shepherd love images. Also, chapter 4 describes various shepherd spaces. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak or the hill of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. And so we can see, I grant, that Solomon may have been smitten by this Shulamite woman and said, let's go get her. Let's take her into my home. But it seems to describe a shepherd and a Shulamite who know each other well, as close as brother and sister. Not literally his sister, but a friendship so close as to be like brother and sister together. You might say they grew up together, if we speculated. Chapter 4, verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. If we go and read the things that Solomon accumulated for himself, part of it was wine and spices, and gold, and horses, and wives. Here, the bridegroom says, your love is better far than any of these things. Now the shepherd cries in chapter 6, verse 13, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? She's not meant for an audience, he is saying. And yet what do kings do with their wives? They parade them, don't they? Think of Queen Vashti, of King Xerxes. Queen Vashti is disgusted by the request of the king, but normally she was supposed to say yes. Whatever the king demanded, she would do. She might say, why am I being displayed as upon a dance before two armies? And here, the shepherd says, you are not meant for this, my Shulamite. Return. And also the girl, she says, my beloved is knocking, open to me. Chapter 5, verse 2. My sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. Verse 6, I opened, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, he gave no answer. She goes out to search for him. The watchmen beat me. They bruised me. They took my veil away, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. So, how is this then a song of songs which is of Solomon? I'll unpack that for a moment and we'll conclude. Solomon is contemplating, I would suggest, a love he never received. Solomon is writing a poetic expression concerning the one who was diligent to her own, the one who is steadfast even when the king came to woo her, even though the riches of the kingdom and Solomon's harem were open to her. You could say it's a celebration of simple love between a man and a woman, without any of the trappings of royalty, without any of the trappings of the things that people might be swayed by. The Shulamite girl is described in such a contrast with Jezebel, Ahab's wife, or even Vashti. She's described in such simple terms. She's beautiful, devoted, seeking after her husband or husband-to-be. She's wise beyond her years. She's one in whom the Spirit of God dwells, having this wisdom from above. And the love of the simple shepherd boy for his bride is greater far than the love which a king might lavish upon his thousandth wife. Even if he really likes the thousandth wife, even if she is near and dear to him for a moment, that too will fade. For the man who has everything, Solomon, stands before the truth that he cannot have what the bride has in chapter 7, verse 10. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. So one writer says, the Jewish scholar Rashi wrote that Solomon wrote this song not in his youth, but in his old age, and that he did so as an act of contrition, out of sorrow. In other words, in view of his idolatrous, polygamous relationships that led his heart away from the Lord, 1 Kings 1 through 11, and away from sexual purity and marital intimacy, he sets himself up as the foil in this song. Thus he writes this greatest of his songs in a self-deprecating tone to say to his first readers and to us, listen, on this matter of marriage, do as I say, not as I did. Put differently, he says, don't emulate my love life, emulate theirs. This imaginary or perhaps real couple, emulate their simple, monogamous, faithful, passionate love for each other. And I think he's right. The Song of Songs is a celebration of simple, committed, passionate love that is not something that belongs in our understanding of Solomon. Solomon is far too complex a character and far too flawed a character to seem to have been able to be the beloved. But he does seem to be a man who could look upon the love with the wisdom that he had to look and consider whether they were imaginary characters or real individuals and say, that is beauty. That is God-honoring. That is something that even the riches of the world, even me with all my concubines and wives, you'd see it at the end of his life saying, I would give up everything just for that. Think of those that have walked out on the wife of their youth, and then at the end realize the great toll that it took to lack devotion to the wife of your youth, or to turn aside to whomever it is that crosses your path. The Lord says, I call you to a way of purity and then intimacy in marriage. Now, as a latter application, do we not see Christ and his church in this? For if Ezekiel chapter 38 depicts the sexual promiscuity of two sisters, a story is told there of two sisters who are clearly Judah and Israel, and they're running after all sorts of men, and that's an allegory of Judah and Israel's spiritual sin, then there is something here also. And so it isn't that we are trying to find a meaning for what a navel is and what an ankle is and what we are to think of her locks of hair that are like a goat's hair. We don't have to try to find a one-to-one correlation, but the whole theme of love between a husband and a wife undoubtedly is a depiction also, or a portrait or a forthtelling of the love that Christ has for us. Christ who says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Who says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. My love for you does not grow cold. My passion for you, my seeking you out, all the various ways in which we see a bride set on a path of loving her husband and vice versa. That the Lord says, so it is for the church and Christ. That's why Paul says, a man shall leave his father and mother, and as we see in the Song of Songs, he shall hold fast to his wife. And the two shall become one flesh, described so vividly in chapter 4 into chapter 5. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. That's sexual imagery, and it's beautiful. That's sexual imagery of consummation. I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. He's delighting in his wife. They are one flesh. And what a beautiful, not filthy, but beautiful description of what it is to have one flesh. Something that we ought to remember, that we ought to celebrate. It is a good gift to be married. And Paul says, this mystery is profound. And I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. And so all throughout the scriptures, we see various descriptions of the Lord's love for us as our bridegroom. Already in chapter Isaiah chapter 62, God says, you shall no more, to the people of God, be termed forsaken. Your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, my delight is in her, and your land married. For the Lord delights in you, and your land shall be married. Or 2 Corinthians, which I referred to earlier, for I feel a divine jealousy for you, Paul says, since I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. And Revelation, the various descriptions of the bridegroom coming to his own. And so throughout, we see a bridegroom rejoicing over his bride. And in the story of God's people, the bridegroom is not even faithful. The bridegroom spoils her honeymoon with spiritual promiscuity, with adultery. And yet, when we see Christ, he is the very one who brings us home. He is our bridegroom, our one husband. And our part in his kingdom is like a wedding banquet. The song, as one writer says, is a song about human love set in the context of marriage, which is found in the Bible. And the Bible's ultimate reference point is Jesus. And so whatever our experience of marriage, God is giving us a pattern of perfection that should inspire us all. That we are staggered, we are thrilled by his grace in choosing us as his bride. That we are refreshed as he constantly reassures us of his love, which he gives to us. We are encouraged to lavish praise on our husband. We are warned that sometimes our love for him can grow cold, but then we are comforted by the way in which he restores our love for him. And so behind every good story, we say, is the great story. Here behind this great love poem is the great love with which he has loved us in the Beloved. And so let's take time for questions or comments, and then we'll close in a word of prayer. Anything?